Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Hagai Matar, Executive Director for the Advancement of Citizen Journalism at Plus 972 Magazine, joins me to discuss the ousting of Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel and how the new ruling coalition dominated by the right wing may not be better and maybe even worse.
And Heather Digby Parton will help me run down the biggest news stories of the week. Hey folks, don't forget, this show relies on your support. You can become a member over at ROFpodcast.com. And when you do, you not only support this show, keep it alive week to week, you also get extra content. This week, I sat down with Hunter Walker. He is a longtime local reporter from New York City, although I guess he's also a national reporter as well. But he's covered local politics in New York City. And this week, or I should say this coming Tuesday, is the Democratic primary for the race for mayor in New York City. New York City, obviously, the biggest city in the country. It has a lot of weird interplay with the governor of New York State. And we are moving into an era, I think, in this country where states like New York and California and cities like L.A. and New York are going to end up being the laboratories for what we can do with our governments. So a very key race. And in New York, if you win the Democratic primary, you more or less win the general election. But who knows? But it should be interesting for you. It's been a crazy race. And that is available to you as a member. So head to ROFpodcast.com and check it out. So, Heather, here we are. We are in the, I wish we had coined some phrase for the Biden's second 100 days, but we are in the midst of it, and things are just as hazy and sort of obtuse as they have been at any other time. We know that the Senate Democrats have begun the reconciliation process. This is a very long process, of course. They are anticipating that if they go via reconciliation, it's not going to happen until probably mid to late July. They will take that vote. But meanwhile, President Joe Biden has been out of the country and meeting with the G7, with a summit with Putin. Domestically, a group of a gang of 10, five Republicans, five Democrats have been negotiating a deal. We know the rough outlines of that deal. But there's been so much drama that has taken place over the past, I would say, 36 hours regarding that. Now, you know, this is in any other context, if there wasn't trillions of dollars at stake here, this would feel like some type of junior high drama where, you know, somebody was sitting with somebody at the cafeteria and then somebody else got mad. And so there's a bunch of people who are pretending they're friends with one person when they're not really. The only difference is that there are trillions of dollars in the balance. The a potential opportunity to invest in our infrastructure, both physical and human, lays in the balance here. And also, you know, some other revelations this week suggest that maybe there's an opportunity for filibuster reform. Maybe there's an opportunity for some iteration of a For the People Act and a John Lewis Voting Rights Act. We will go through all of this, but I don't know. What's your first reactions on this week?
Well, it's exactly what you just said. I mean, it does have this feeling of, you know, oh, this is my good friend. We're going to be best friends this week. And then, oh, you know, I heard she said something behind my back. And so now I'm going to go over and be friends with this person. I mean, that is the dynamic here, which is, you know, basically it's the big man on campus mm-hmm. who is Joe Manchin. It's not the president. He's off in, you know, Europe doing his president thing. And our domestic president, Joe Manchin, is doing his thing up on Capitol Hill. And so we have this, you know, I don't know if it's a pretense. I mean, last week when we talked, I was really, you know, pretty pessimistic. And I said, I think the agenda's dead. I'm still not sure it isn't, because we keep hearing Mitch McConnell, who is, you know, the other domestic president. And he's saying no to pretty much everything. That is the line he's taking. John Barrasso, who is the senator from, what's he from, Wyoming? And he's up there. He's one of the, you know, he's the main messaging guy or whatever. And he's having a meeting every week. And you know, the press shows up. And he said this week, we don't want to just make Joe Biden a one-term president. We want to make him a half-term president. That is what we're doing. We want to make him lose the election in 2022. We want the Democrats to lose the House and Senate. Okay. I mean, no big news there. But they're just saying it. I mean, they're not talking about governing. They're not talking about, well, you know, we'd really like to get this done and maybe we can talk. No, they're not even making a pretense to that. So I remain leaning on the pessimistic side in terms of the Biden agenda, the Democratic agenda, you know, in the short term, because, you know, I just don't see Mitch McConnell letting this happen. Having said that, who knows? I mean, maybe there's some kind of dynamic here. Maybe Mitch is, you know, losing his grip. I mean, maybe they're all playing games for the Fox News audience. I don't know. But the events of this week with the, you know, the cafeteria table thing going on, I mean, it does show, at least to some extent, that it's exposed where everybody is sitting in the cafeteria.
Right.
It exposes who the Democrats are, for one thing, who are into this bipartisan thing and they are working with Manchin. And it exposes on the Republican side, at least some who are willing to pretend that they want to be bipartisan, which is a thing in the Republican Party, because, you know, over on Fox, it's just all obstruction all the time. Even pretending to be bipartisan is actually a, you know, a courageous move. So now we know where they're sitting and who's talking to who and what is actually starting, you know, what they're actually pretending to do, whether or not it actually happens. So, you know, the first one off the big news, I think, this week was the infrastructure bill.
Right. Well, let me just stop you there so that we get, like, you know, so we can, because I love the carrying that metaphor as to where everybody's sitting in the cafeteria. You said Barrasso, you know, sort of came out with that comment that and we should be clear here, right? No party wants the opposing president to win their election and every party in the off year election. But when you articulate that mm-hmm. as the standard, what you're doing is you're basically saying, we're not going to do it by, like, we are giving ourselves license to completely obstruct
right.
a naked manner, not to not come to a deal, not to negotiate in good faith and this and that. We are giving ourselves a license relative to our constituents. They know what the expectations are. We feel comfortable that they know that that's the expectation. And that, and so that implicates their demeanor and their approach. Mitch McConnell earlier in the week also said, in an interview with the ODSU Hewitt, that Joe Biden will not get a Supreme Court pick in 2024. And he'll mm-hmm. probably not get one in 2023 in the event that the Republicans control the Senate. Now, I believe McConnell. I also believe that he's saying that now because that is what he believes will drive a lot of Republicans to the polls in 2022 and 2020, you know. And so that is, again, another signal to the idea that there is no bipartisanship here. And the reason why, like, you know, I'm locating these people in the cafeteria, because when we ultimately get to Joe Manchin, Joe Manchin has been trying to argue they're sitting over here and all signs point to them sitting over there. And we have a leaked audio of him talking to, you know, I'm trying to think of what the metaphor is. I don't know who would come in and buy the school from the principals or but whoever they maybe, you know, when they used to put the Coke or Pepsi in the cafeteria and there was a big controversy. Should we have a soda machine? But they're paying for all the textbooks. Maybe make a conversation with those people, essentially. He indicates that he knows that what happened with that January 6th commission makes his case untenable, that there is an opportunity for bipartisanship. So he is sensitive to that. And so anytime somebody comes out and proves him wrong, obviously it's not determinant, but it is like one more, you know, piece of straw on the camel's back. It is helpful for those of us who want him to reform the filibuster. And we'll get to that leaked audio. But I just wanted to, you know, to carry through, like, you know, where at least over the course of the week people were sitting. So the infrastructure bill, we've got a gang of 10 with a $1 trillion bill. About 600 of it, billion is new spending. It is paid for, or some of the pay for, the other like 30 or 40 billion dollars, excuse me, 300, $400 billion was already earmarked in the COVID relief bill. So, I mean, take it from there. I mean, so because there's been new revelations, you know, as late as Wednesday and Thursday of this week as to where that gang of 10 is on their negotiations or where they supposedly are.
Right. You know, and again, that's very important. Because this is very, you know, they're all doing a lot of dancing here and we don't know exactly what's real and what isn't, you know, and it's not atypical for negotiations. I mean, people take positions that, you know, are there for a different reason than what they appear to be. So I'm not, you know, putting them down for that necessarily, but that we're in the middle of that. So take it at with a grain of salt, whatever it is you're hearing. But what has happened is then there's 20 senators, allegedly.
There's allegedly 21, 11 of whom are Republicans. Let me write off the names here. Richard Burr of North Carolina, Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, Susan Collins of Maine, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. That's four. Murkowski is five. Portman is six. Mitt Romney is seven. Mike Rounds is eight. Tom Tillis of North Carolina is nine. Todd Young of Indiana and Jerry Moran of Kansas. So that's 11. 10 is the magic number. And then might as well read the Democrats who are part of this 21. Chris Coons, which is not terribly unexpected, but remember, he is very close with Joe Biden. Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire, John Hickenlooper of Colorado, Mark Kelly of Arizona, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Gene Shaheen of New Hampshire, Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, and Mark Warner of Virginia, and then Senator Angus King, who is an independent but caucuses with the Democrats. I don't know. You tell me, Digby. What are we seeing? You know. It's more like these people are entering the cafeteria and saying, we're going to sit over there, but first we're going to go get into it. Right?
Well, that is what it's like. Yeah. They're kind of going, you know, they're waving at each other from their respective tables. Oh, you know, you, me, yeah. You know, I mean, it's not.
They come out with their tray and then all this.
Right. Look around. I mean, I can just see them in their little school uniforms doing this. You know, it's of course. I mean, this is what, and it's the totally expected group, right? I mean, I'm not surprised by anybody on either side, to be honest. I mean, I guess maybe Graham kind of surprises me, but he's always, you know, he likes to be a maverick and, you know, do his thing. Besides which, he's probably taking, you know, whatever they're saying amongst themselves and going directly to Mitch and saying, you know, here's what you need to do. But in any case, they, you know, that is the group that has come together allegedly with this infrastructure bill, which includes, you know, many things that we all, you know, are in favor of. I mean, certainly doing the hard infrastructure that they're talking about, roads and bridges and schools and the rest. That's something that both sides apparently do agree on. It's just a matter of, you know, where the money's coming from and how much money they're going to spend. But there are a couple of really big problems. The first one being is that the Republicans are balking across the board at the green element of the deal, at least to the extent that we haven't heard the details, but one of the big details has come up. They don't want the government paying for electric charging stations. For some unknown reason, this is really a big deal to these Republicans. We cannot have government interference in our electric charging station issue. So, you know, this is a big problem. They had somebody come in from San Diego, I read yesterday. So she works for one of the energy companies, and saying, oh, you don't have to worry because the energy companies are all putting in electric charging stations. And basically, we don't need to subsidize that, you know, and you're going, okay, whatever. But they have these things. And this is a big stumbling block, of course, for the Democrats, because, and rightly so, because if you're talking about infrastructure, if you do not emphasize the green side of it, we're screwed. I mean, it's, you know, absolutely impossible to do infrastructure if you are not taking every, you know, opportunity here to try and green up this country, create the good paying jobs that will do it, but prepare somewhat, at least a little bit, for this crisis that we're currently facing of climate change. So the idea that they're balking on that is very troubling. And you've got people like, I mean, I think it's Sheldon Whitehouse, and of course, Ed Markey in Massachusetts, others who are just screaming about this, going, you better be kidding. You know, no, we're not going to do that. And Democrats are right to hold out on that. And that's just one example. I mean, there are a lot of individual specific issues in this infrastructure bill. And I'm not talking about the child care stuff or that we'll come to that in a minute. I'm just talking about just the physical infrastructure part of this, which is, you know, it just, there is no choice here. It cannot be done any other way than by doing it with doing the green infrastructure. It has to be done that way. And they can call it something else if they want. I don't care. Right. You know, they can call it the oil and gas infrastructure, but they have to do it this way, or we're in a big, big, big mess. So that is one of the big roadblocks here that we're dealing with that we know of. And there may be many more.
Yeah. I mean, we're likely in a big mess either way.
Right.
The concept of contemplating infrastructure in the year 2021 without the foundational principle being, how do we prepare for climate change? How do we mitigate what we're doing in terms of causing climate change going forward? And how do we mitigate the impact of climate change as it becomes more manifest? The idea that wouldn't be the sort of foundational principle of what you're doing when you're talking about infrastructure is just, I mean, it's the functional equivalent of us at this point going like, well, okay, yeah, we don't want to get involved in charging stations, but maybe we should set up some troughs for the horse there, you know. Like it is so absurd not to contemplate what the future is going to be like when you're doing infrastructure. We're making an investment. Investments are necessarily about contemplating what happens in the future. The idea that you wouldn't do this, forget that it's, and that is, you know, that it's tagged as being environmental or green. It's just infrastructure. It is realizing what the future is going to be.
Call it modern infrastructure. How about that? Just leave the green out of it, whatever.
Right. I mean, it's like, I don't know. We live in Seattle. Let's not plan for it to rain. I mean, like, that type of thing. That part is absurd. When we come back, let's take a break. Let's talk about how some of the Democrats are responding to the idea that they're supposedly, you know, 11 Republicans signed on to this, because the progressives are basically drawing a line in the sand about this. Mm-hmm. And then we will talk more about, you know, President Manchin's conversation with some billionaires who are part of this no labels group that was apparently recorded and leaked. And I think you might have some theories as to what's going on with some of those things. We will talk about that when we return. I'm Sam Cedar talking to Heather Parton. We'll be back in just a moment. So, Heather, we've been talking about probably the same thing that we've been talking about for weeks and maybe months, but it is the next 40 days are probably the most consequential of the Biden presidency, it seems to me. We will find out, maybe 50 days, we will find out whether Joe Biden gets an infrastructure bill or whether his presidency more or less, you know, ends from a legislative perspective, you know, because we're either going to get a reconciliation bill or we're going to get this sort of bipartisan infrastructure bill, or we could get both or we could get none. And it all seems to have to happen in the next 2 months. I mean, I guess it's conceivable that it could happen after that, but it all has to happen in the next 2 months. And with that backdrop, Joe Manchin, we've been going back and forth. You know, he keeps writing sort of like he's like playing both sides of a tennis court on some level, it seems like, mm-hmm. with op-ed saying, I'm not going to do anything that you guys are hoping that I'm going to do. And then at different times, he says, like, I'm open to a talking filibuster, or I'm open to $4 trillion infrastructure. And then it's almost like we got a look into his mind, because it would be the equivalent of, like, many people when they're talking to their therapist, or maybe when they've, you know, taken some type of truth serum. He was in a conversation with billionaires of the No Labels organization, and basically said, a bunch of things. One being, I need you guys to help, particularly with Roy Blunt, because we would have had, if Toomey was in town, we would have needed only three new Republicans to vote for the January 6th commission. And he said, you know, it's really tough on me, because it's really hard for me to argue that we don't, you know, that the filibuster makes sense when we can't even get him to do the most bipartisan thing that's possible. And then he went on to say that he's open to some filibuster reform. Who knows what that means? He also was talking about, like, you know, what voting rights bills he would want and this and that. What do you make of all that? Like, first of all, how did we get that audio? That all and sort of.
I don't know, but there's a lot of leaking going on in a lot of ways. Recently, they had that big thing with all the rich people's tax returns leaked to ProPublica, too. And this one was actually more surprising, because it had to be somebody on the call, and I don't know who, but it was run by Third Way, No Labels.
Right.
Which is Joe Lieberman's group, right? What need I say more? And it's composed of a bunch of very, very wealthy donors and benefactors to Republicans and Democrats. They are the benefactors for this group at the cafeteria we were talking about in the last second segment. That this is their parents. Okay. This is the parents. And so Manchin, very comfortable with this group. He is, a member in good standing with this No Labels crew. And he was basically, I think he was being pretty honest with them. I mean, I got the feeling from listening to it and reading the full transcript that he felt very comfortable with being with these guys and with telling them what he really had in mind, that this is the, you know, and what he said basically was, I need you to help with some of these guys. He said Roy Blunt in particular. But he said with some other ones that he indicated pretty clearly that anybody who was retiring, these guys could be helpful. These guys could step up, maybe, you know, add a little bit, sweeten the pie a little bit for some of them, and maybe he could get them to come around. That was pretty obvious. And I've never seen anything so openly corrupt just blurted out like
that. Unbelievable. Like, you know, I think we've always speculated something like this, but that is really, really, it's really stunning. I mean,
yeah. I mean, he just basically said it. I mean, just, you know, you can really help us out here. And his reasoning, of course, was we have to appease the far left with this January 6th commission because they're upset and it makes me look bad because I think there can be bipartisanship and this shows that there is no bipartisanship. Right. And this was his entire argument there. But he did go on to talk a bit about what he might do. I mean, as you said, he might, you know, be willing to. He was a little vague about the details on the filibuster, but he kind of said, well, maybe I got the sense that he would like wanted to lower the threshold to 55, maybe do a talking filibuster thing of some kind.
It sounded to me that he was saying instead of needing 60 votes to break a filibuster, you need at least 41 votes to maintain it. So, for instance, in the January 6th commission, the vote was something like 55 to 35, and the 35 won. And so he's basically saying you need 41 instead of
big reform.
Instead of requiring the 55 to get to 60.
Right.
So, I mean, it makes it a little more inconvenient. There may be other things, you know, he may drop the threshold and stuff like that. But this is also a group that doesn't want any change to the filibuster because they know what the filibuster is there for. It is to prevent any real legislative action that, you know, would reflect the will of the people.
That they don't want. Right. I mean, and to me, that's the other big revelation in this is why would no labels care about the filibuster? This is a group, it's bipartisanship, blah, 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 you know. But I mean, this is, you know, the filibuster, they should be able to get 51 votes, the no labels group. I mean, we've talked about this, how sometimes, you know, having a 50-50 Senate makes no difference, that sometimes, you know, you're just getting Joe Manchin over the line is tough enough to do. So they have other roadblocks. Why are they so attached to the filibuster? And they seemed really adamant about it on the call, that this was something that really concerned them a lot. And then he did talk about the voting rights. Another reason, why does no labels care about these voting rights? Voting rights are just, this is just a democracy thing. It's not really, it shouldn't be partisan. It is, of course, voting rights always are because we have a conservative party in this country, whether it's Democratic Party in the past or the Republican Party today that want to keep people from voting, particularly people of color, you know, American citizen, you know, people who were immigrated from other countries and became citizens and students and basically liberals. So that is part of that's a partisan thing. And why no labels of anything? They should be for voting rights, right? Because that's a bipartisan thing, both sides, you know, you would think that they would do it. So they gave themselves away a lot on this call, as did Joe Manchin. Having said that, the substance of it does lead potentially to maybe some of, you know, Joe Manchin came out shortly afterwards with a long list of things he would agree to in a voting rights bill, which was actually not bad.
Right.
Surprisingly good. I mean, some of the things that he was giving the other side, things like, you know, voter ID, well, they've done some studies and found that voter ID doesn't really inhibit voting as much as people thought it would. And it's a very loose voter ID thing that he put out there. And some other things that he would give them, like, you know, you should be allowed to purge the voter rolls, et cetera, but nothing really draconian. You know, I mean, it wasn't like something where he was giving away the store to the Republicans. So that sounds good. But then I'm watching today. I mean, I'm reading my Twitter feed and along comes a quote from Roy Blunt, the famous Roy Blunt, who needs to have the pot sweetened just a little bit to make him come around. And he says, well, Manchin's voting rights list looked pretty good. And we had some, you know, we may have some agreement on that. But then Stacey Abrams came out and said she endorsed it. So I don't think that's going to happen. And that just tells you everything. I mean, and this is not unusual. They do this all the time. It's like, oh, well, until Nancy Pelosi gave that speech and hurt our feelings, we were all for it, but now we can't do it. So look, you know, people are moving around and they're looking for reasons not to do it without actually saying that they don't want to do it.
It's going to come down to, how is the 11 Republicans who have supposedly endorsed this, how is their bluff about to be called? How strong will progressives be on towing the line? Because look, the big fear is that people have that is going to be like, we passed this infrastructure bill and with the idea that supposedly we're then going to go into reconciliation and pass more, and that Joe Manchin at that point has his, you know, quarter of a loaf of bread and is not, you know, is going to be fine with that. And he's right. going to vote for that reconciliation. And then you lose the opportunity for that stuff. So it's going to be interesting to see how the progressives play this, how Joe Biden plays this. We will see. I mean, $1 trillion, only $600 billion of it is new money is just not sufficient. And to ignore the human infrastructure, as they call it, and to ignore the reality of climate change, to not tailor a bill to that is just, you know, it's just bizarre. I know we wanted to talk about that great piece that Mike Konzol had written in the New York Times. We won't have a chance to talk about it today, but I will probably be talking to Mike Konzol over the next week or so. And we we can talk about it next week. But basically, the gist of it was, don't get fooled by this hair on fire about inflation. Let us have the boom that we're going to have. The inflation stuff is easily explained by the fact that we are ramping up. Like I say, I can take my mask off one day and say, I'm going into a restaurant. But it takes a lot longer for a restaurant to say, wait, we've got to buy more, we've got to buy more food and we've got to, get more wait staff and more cooks back on the line. So that's basically what we're dealing with. You know, the demand is not outstripping our capacity. It is just faster than our ability to provide at the moment. But we will talk more about that next week. Until then, Heather, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Israel's latest round of elections have shaken things up. After 2 years of gridlock and four elections, it appears that the embattled far-right leader Benjamin Netanyahu is on his way out after over a decade in office. But will the new political alliance be an improvement? Here to answer these questions is Hagai Matar, award-winning Israeli journalist and activist and executive director for the Advancement of Citizen Journalism at Plus 972 Magazine. His piece on the Israeli elections is entitled Israel's Likely New Government Explained. Welcome to the show, Hagai.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
So this outcome comes after the assault on Gaza, the deaths of hundreds of Palestinians and over 10 Israelis killed, which was clearly a conflict that's flames were fanned by Benjamin Netanyahu in order to kind of maintain his grip on power. This is not the first time he's done something like this. That seems to not have worked. So if you could just first set the stage for us, coming off the heels of this latest bloody inflection point, and then we can move into the finer aspects of the election.
Sure, of course. It's an excellent question. Basically, I think one of the things that Netanyahu has become actually known for throughout his last 12 years in power has been to, most of the time, be able to carry out assaults on Palestinians in a way that would gain Israel the most control over land, do the most harm for the Palestinian cause, but with getting as little attention as possible for it. So actually such campaigns, like massive campaigns of killing hundreds of people in Gaza, are things we haven't seen that many of throughout his 12 years in power. There was 2014, the terrible assault on Gaza then. But other than that, Netanyahu really does try or has tried to keep things quieter. I think what we saw now was really part of a desperate attempt, not only in Gaza, but also in Jerusalem, to escalate things in a way that would make it so much harder for this new coalition to be formed, considering that the new coalition is kind of this ragtag group of Palestinian Islamists, Israeli Jewish religious hardliners on the right, centrist leftists. It's a very, very mixed coalition. I think Netanyahu's thinking around this was that such a delicate and diverse coalition will not be able to survive something like this. It actually worked for a short while as the rockets were firing. Naftali Bennett, who is about to be the new prime minister, basically said he's ending negotiations. He's going back to work with Netanyahu when there will be no alternative government. The war stopped and Naftali Bennett went back to negotiations. And now we have this government.
And part of that is because this new coalition contains, as you say, this ragtag group, which includes Palestinian Islamists and members of the, I may be butchering this, but I believe there was one Palestinian member of the Knesset who kind of broke off from the traditional coalition of Palestinian representatives. Can you talk about his role? Is it Abbas? Am I getting that correct?
Abbas.
All right,
yeah,
good. I remember.
Precisely right.
Okay.
It's just that this coalition of Palestinian parties is actually fairly new. It started in 2015 and became this alliance called the Joint List, wherein all the different Palestinian parties, these are Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, not the ones in the occupied territories. So those four parties, the different strands of Palestinian politics within Israel, which is the Islamist, the national, the communist, and kind of a populist in between, all four of them decided to run together and create this joint list. That worked for a short while. But yeah, now Mansour Abbas basically broke away with that, trying to make himself the new kingmaker of all Israeli politics. He actually suggested to Netanyahu that he would ally with him. And it was very, very close to Netanyahu actually forming a coalition with Mansour Abbas, the Islamist who broke away from the joint list. It was actually Netanyahu's own other coalition members who are on the extreme right, who said, we will never sit in a government with Arabs. This is a no-go for us. And they were the ones to actually prevent it. Netanyahu was interested, Abbas was interested. I think the interesting thing about this was that up until now, it's been kind of this mainstay in Jewish Israeli politics that Palestinian parties are out of the game. They're not part of the legitimate forces you can ally with to create a coalition. What Netanyahu actually did here was, from his position on the right, legitimize negotiating with Palestinian parties, say, I'm willing to do this, which then later allowed this new coalition to do the same.
So, I mean, Abbas, I think the dynamic from what I've read reminds me a little bit about Joe Manchin here in the United States, who's like this figure whose desire is to put himself front and center and to borrow George W. Bush, his phrase, be the decider at the end of everything, essentially. And so Abbas is centering himself in that same way. And just from an American perspective, I'm not this joint list, the Palestinian coalition of members of the Knesset. How adequate was their representation of Palestinian citizens of Israel? I mean, putting aside the fact that there's not representation for Palestinians in the occupied territories. I mean, was it considered a moderate to leftist representation? I mean, do leftist activists find their advocacy sufficient? What's kind of the dynamic there?
So because it's such a coalition in itself, this grouping of different strands of Palestinian politics, you could hear a lot of different criticism from the different factions for the concessions made. So you would hear LGBTQ activists criticizing the Communist Party for allying with Islamists and supporting its homophobia. And you can hear Islamists that are critical of Abbas for allying with communists and the liberals because they're promoting feminist agendas. So you actually had different people criticizing this group from different angles. There's also another layer of Palestinian politics within Israel of people saying we should boycott the elections altogether. We should not be a part of this political game at all. So that's another angle. And then you also have some people for whom the joint list was taking too much of a hard line and were saying we should be closer to Jewish parties. We should try to give up on some of our national aspirations. We should stop talking about the occupied territories and our brothers and sisters over there. They have to fend for themselves. And I think basically what Mansour Abbas did was to capitalize on that, basically saying, I'm dropping the notion of being Palestinian, I'm dropping the national demands, I'm dropping concerns for the occupation, and all I want is some basically more money to go into special projects for my constituencies. And that's basically all that I need.
I don't want to harp on this too much, but I'm just trying to fully understand. Is this a way, does this put a wedge in between Palestinians living within Israel and the occupied territories and the Palestinians living in the occupied territories? Is that kind of the dynamic at play here?
For sure, definitely. It's been a very long discussion within Jewish Israeli politics with the Zionist parties, basically blaming the joint list, blaming all forms of Palestinian leadership, saying you should take care only of your own people, i.e. Palestinian citizens of Israel. And the fact that you have family members and brethren in the occupied territories, that's none of your concern. You just take care of your own people and, you know, forget about Gaza and our attacks there. Forget about this, forget about that. Abbas is basically the first to actually go with that line and say, you know what? You're right.
Like, that's pretty odious. That's pretty odious. I'll say that. So, I mean, I'll editorialize and put that out there. But I mean, he's clearly a useful tool for the right wing in Israel and a face for that kind of perspective, which is helpful for the right wing, I would imagine. And so before we talk about the joint list for the entirety of our time together, which is too short, I want to actually dive into the government that's going to come to be created, because as you said, it's a bit of an unlikely alliance. Did this happen just because the political opposition to Netanyahu was more centered around being anti-Bibi, anti-Netanyahu than it was like we have an ideological alignment here?
Definitely. There is no ideological alignment in this coalition, none whatsoever. The only thing keeping them all together is their will to see Netanyahu go for different reasons. Palestinians have their reasons to object to Netanyahu. The left has been obviously campaigning against Netanyahu for a very long time. Parts of the left, you could say, have really become committed to the slogan of anything but Netanyahu. So if you look at negotiations to form this new government, you can actually see that the Zionist left parties really didn't ask for much, definitely in comparison with the right-wing parties in this coalition. The left didn't ask for much, neither in policy nor in ministries or budgets or anything like that, because it was a given that if it's a coalition without Netanyahu, they're in, they're sold. They can't really negotiate. But then in the center and parts of the right, you also have this liberal agenda saying Netanyahu has become a threat to the very foundations of Israeli democracy, or what is perceived as Israeli democracy. So it's not just about what he does to Palestinians, which most of the coalition would actually support. It's about his political corruption, for which he's facing three charges in a trial right now, and also what he's taken on ever since being investigated and indicted, which is an assault against the media, gatekeepers, the prosecution, the courts and their independence. So going after all these institutions, basically dismantling all checks and balances in power, is something that got a lot of people alarmed, even in the right. And that put together with just wanting to replace him after so long and get some new blood in there, with the left and the Palestinians, all these different reasons is what created this coalition and will be the only thing to keep it going.
We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will dive into the leaders in this coalition, who the likely new prime minister will be, as well as the greater implications for Israeli politics and what the bigger problem is that this paper's over. We'll be right back. So before we broke, we were just kind of breaking down the broader view of the new governing coalition in Israel. Now, Naftali Bennett, he is set to be the new prime minister. Who is he? And what can you tell us about him?
So interestingly, just to look at the past couple of years, Naftali Bennett has been a political loser as of late. He announced a new party just 2 years ago in the first round, the first of four rounds of elections we've seen in the past 2 years, and didn't even make it past the electoral threshold. He was just kept outside. He went to the ballots to try and count ballots, try and find the missing few thousand that would get him through the threshold, and failed. And even now, he's entering this coalition with six members of Knesset. It's one of the smallest parties in this coalition. Six members of Knesset out of 120 is a very, very, very small party, which the only reason that he will become prime minister, and he will be prime minister for just 2 years, there'll be a rotation between him and another leader, Yair Lapid. So the only reason he was able to do that was that everyone else was already sold on this coalition, and he had the bargaining power to say, you know what, I can go to Netanyahu, I can go to another round of elections, and the only way I'm coming into this coalition is if I'm prime minister. So he had that leverage. If you look at his history, first he's the first Israeli religious person to be prime minister. He comes from the very depth of the settlement project. So he's very much pro-annexation. He used to be the head of the Yesha Council, which is sort of the organizing body of the settlers, and has spent most of his political career in that kind of hardline, hawkish, pro-settlement, pro-annexation right. And that's basically who he is, to think that he would become prime minister with the votes of Palestinians and of the Zionist left, who saw him as their main nemesis for many years, is shocking and just testament to how Israeli politics has become twisted and morphed over the past few years.
Yeah, and to put it incredibly simply, and you know, I guess iron out some of the complexities here. Is there a sense of who's further right, Bennett or Netanyahu?
I would definitely say Bennett. No question about it.
Great.
For many years, he was in Netanyahu's coalition. He was Netanyahu's chief of staff and was a minister under Netanyahu, and was always tagging him on the right, trying to promote even more aggressive policies of annexation, more aggressive policies in Gaza. So that's basically what he has stood for most of his career.
And who is going to populate his cabinet, right? So, I mean, it seems like Benny Gantz, who really flipped after the last election, or I guess he seemed to weasel his way into power in a few different instances. You've got Avigdor Lieberman, who I remember as a member of Netanyahu's administration as well, as chief of staff, if that's accurate. So, I mean, there seems to be a hodgepodge of people here in the right wing. If you could just give us a sense of who's going to be ruling alongside Bennett.
Yeah, sure. If you look at the top ministries beyond the prime minister, you mentioned Gantz as minister of defense and Lieberman as minister of finance. Gantz has really built a career as the former chief of staff. He campaigned on leveling Gaza and sending it back to the Stone Age in 2014 as chief of staff, and that's been kind of his claim to fame in his politics. If you look at Lieberman, this is the person who built his career on inciting against the two poorest communities within Israel. This is Palestinian citizens and the ultra-Orthodox, the two poorest communities, and he will be the Minister of Finance. So the chances of a progressive social policy are very slim. Looking further to the Minister of Justice, it's Gideon Saar, yet another former Likud and Netanyahu ally, also very much on the right, who wants to promote another curtailing of the independence of the judiciary. If you look at the Minister for Internal Affairs, it's Ayala Shaked of Bennett's party, who has proudly said essentially that she's a fascist. She will be responsible for the policy on asylum seekers, whom she wishes to deport, basically all of them, and on municipal
specifically affairs. African asylum seekers. Accurate.
That's almost all of these.
Okay, gotcha.
Asylum seekers. We
well, I just here. Wanted to emphasize the racism embedded in that. So
definitely, yes. Very much. So we're talking about a very, very small community of about 20,000 people. This isn't a situation, you know, where you have millions of people. It's 20,000 people from Eritrea and Sudan mostly, and she's been really campaigning on deporting them. She might actually have that authority now as Minister of Internal Affairs. You can go on and on, but the top ministries are held by the right. You have some ministries that are held by the left, and it'll be interesting to see what sort of policies this government makes in between the differences that these different players have. They're trying to agree not to make any drastic steps on anything, but how do you govern without taking any steps? That remains to be seen.
So substantively, there seems to be no fundamental difference in how this new governing coalition will operate in regards to Palestine, except maybe even further, right? Which is, you know, from an outside observer, I'm very as passionate as one can be out, you know, not living in Israel or being a part of it, just about the immorality of the occupation. And we've done numerous interviews about it. It's quite disheartening. And I would imagine it's very disheartening for you as well, because as you write in your piece, there is a Jewish supremacism in the way that a lot of Israelis are voting that seems to be impossible to root out, and the left is a shell of itself. So I don't even know how to begin to diagnose that or solve that. I mean, if what 101 out of the 120 Knesset seats are held by a political camp that's on the right wing on the Jewish side, like, how do you even begin to grapple with that?
So first, I agree. It's a very disheartening situation. It's a challenging time. I think it's very much a result of the work that Netanyahu has done in order to turn the occupation into what seems like a sustainable reality, where most Israelis don't see it as a problem or don't see the need to go into a process to solve this thing. People are just content with the way things are and don't want any changes. So it's not about, is it a, you know, one-state solution or a two-state solution? It's about, do you need a solution at all? And most Israelis, I think right now, if you look at our test members, would say that no, we actually don't need a solution. I think there are things that are happening that might change that dynamic. First, with Netanyahu out of the picture, we will see this new government that, while it is held strongly by the right, is also very much dependent on its survival on the left. So, for example, formal annexation, which Bennett would have wanted to do, is something we won't see because the left will prevent it. However, gradual de facto annexation on the ground, which has been happening for decades, will be considered part of the status quo. So that will continue. So that's on the bad side. I think it'll be interesting to see how the left, which has made its main political project to go after Netanyahu personally, how the left operates with Netanyahu gone. With him out of the picture, can the left rebuild itself as an ideological camp with a vision and present an opposition? And I think two more factors that are essential here. We've also seen the past couple of months an uprising of Palestinians throughout the West Bank and within Israel and in Gaza. So there is more Palestinian opposition now than we've seen in a very long time. And public opinion, especially in the US, is changing. And that's starting to put pressure. on Israel. So I think the sustainability of the occupation which Netanyahu created is might be coming to an end for completely other reasons outside of Israeli politics, which might force Israelis to reckon with that and start changing their views on occupation.
I hope so. And it's just disheartening to see such a hollowed out left in Israel. I mean, those numbers are stark in terms of just the dominance of the right wing in the Knesset. And then, of course, you describe the political strategy of basically anybody but Netanyahu, which is entirely unsustainable. But I guess, am I being too harsh? Was that really the only realistic scenario for any sort of minimal gains by the left in Israel, given the state of politics there? Or was that as feckless and shallow as it appears from the outside?
I think it's both. I do think that the left could have played a harder bargain here and not basically announced, if it's not Netanyahu, we're in. And no matter the policy and no matter the ministries, and Bennett can be prime minister, I think they could have opposed that and presented a stronger opposition. At the same time, I do think that it's something to remember that without a functioning government for the past 2 years, without a state budget, with key positions in government service not being filled for quite a long time, the attorney general, the chief of police, the executive director of the finance ministry, these are top positions that have gone unfilled for a very, very long time. And the country is really heading to a complete standstill. And that is catastrophic on many levels, something that Netanyahu was able to use to his advantage. And it's one of the things that also beyond the personal issue of Netanyahu, has also kind of gotten all these players together is the need to just restart the entire system, make sure that there is a budget, that these positions are filled, that the country kind of is able to function and pause the ideological battles. I do hope that once things are restarted and together with pressure from the outside, those battles will reemerge, those ideological battles, and people will have to pick sides on how they view Israel's future and Jewish supremacy in this region. Is that something we want to sustain, or is that something we're questioning and trying to undermine?
Well, I really appreciate your insights on all of this. It was incredibly informative. Hagai Matar, award-winning Israeli journalist and activist, and executive director for the advancement of citizen journalism at Plus 972 magazine. I would encourage everybody to read that magazine. It has been very informative for me. And so I really appreciate your time speaking with me today. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, folks, that's our show today. Thanks so much for joining us. On behalf of Emma Vigeland, I want to say thank you to Heather Parton. And thank you to you for joining us. And a reminder, it is your support that makes the show possible. You can support the free show, you can become a member, and you can get extra content over at rofpodcast.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We will see you, hear you, talk to you again next week. Let's dance to the song.